Hey everyone, this is Diane Ivy, aka Lady Di. I am here with my dear friend Willa, and it's been a while since I did my last podcast, but I'm really happy to have Willa here at my house in my studio, which is a hot mess right now, but she's a great friend, so she doesn't care. So I just want to just let you guys know that I have some other podcasts lined up later on, and check out my newsletter. If you haven't signed up, go to ladydiyarns.com for more information. How's it going, Willa?
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me come over. It's not a mess at all compared to my house, I promise you.
Okay, good. Good. It's okay.
But it's going great. So what's new with yarn?
Well, first of all, what are you knitting or crocheting?
So right now, as it happens, I'm actually crocheting a couple of things. I do knit, but right now I am crocheting. I'm doing some lace thread crochet I have a t-shirt where the neckline is just way too big and it always like falls off or it's too low or whatever. And so I've been saying I'm going to crochet some lace to make some trim to pull that neckline in, and I'm finally getting around to that. So we'll see. I'm just making it up as I go along. So we'll see what happens with that. And I'm also, I got some great yarn at the Common Cod Yarn fabric auction earlier.
Oh, yeah. I didn't get to go.
I know. But it was awesome, and I bought a whole bunch of yarn, and I'm actually crocheting it. I didn't need to, like, let it ripen in my stash for a year, so that was good.
Do you know the joy that I think about with crochet? Because when you crochet, you use more yarn than if you knit.
So it's true. So
it's a great stash buster to
be true. Able to have. It's true. I mean, I guess as a yarn dyer, you want people to use as much yarn
I know,
as possible.
Exactly.
No, just kidding.
Like, if you knit, try crochet. Just take 5 skeins. But so that the viewers and people, the listeners, you know who you are, so tell me a little bit about your background. Like, what do you do? Do you like long walks in the park?
It's like a personal ad here. I don't know. So let's see, a little background about me. I am from New Mexico. I've lived in Massachusetts for a little over a decade. I came here because my partner wanted to go to architecture school. He's not an architect now. It's a whole long story for another day.
Yeah.
But we still live here. He learned to knit actually from a friend of his on the train when he was commuting into Boston, on the commuter rail every day. And he would sit with this woman, Jane, and she would knit socks. And he was like, that looks so cool. I want to do it. And so she brought some needles and some yarn and showed him how to knit. Mm-hmm. And I actually picked up crochet out of self-defense. I had to do something.
Yeah.
I had taught myself to knit a little bit when I was a kid out of a book. And I tried to teach myself crochet, but I could never figure out where you stick the hook in. Like, I'd make the chain I'd be like, there's all these different loops. Which one?
Yeah. We've been there.
Yeah. And so as an adult, I was like, okay, now I have the internet, so I can figure this out. So so he started knitting, I started crocheting, and then I eventually got into knitting and stuff too.
You live like on a farm, kind of. You have horses.
From the point of view of someone who lives in... yes.
Okay. I live on a farm. No, no, I just have land with horses.
I have 2 acres. I have 2 horses. Yeah. It's, you know, very hemmed in suburbia for me because I grew up out in the country at the end of a mile of dirt road. So this is all, there are a lot of people here for me.
Well, I'm glad that you drove into the city to do this. I appreciate
it
very much.
It's a lot of fun.
So one of the big things about my podcast is that I really like to talk about diversity, talk about politics and things that are just happening in the crafting industry. But I have found that when we go to different knitting groups, people just don't talk about the yarn that they have. We talk about things that affect our lives. We talk about politics. And given that Trump, who I affectionately call 45, sometimes Trump will slip out, but I don't really...
We don't want to say that
too often. Exactly. So, you know, 45 became president, and I feel that our crafting industry has been very alive in certain ways. Segment of people. We really captured the nation last year with the Hope Pussy Hat movement. And so we'll talk about that.
Yeah,
but this podcast
there's
is
a lot
about,
to unpack there.
Yes. And, you know, for me, I want to be able to, as a woman of color in this industry, which there are a lot of women of color and men of color in this industry. It's just that we just don't get the same level of recognition or the audience. What I'm doing is I'm creating an audience that represents people of color, but I also call it woke white people. And
we
can talk about that. No, yeah, I mean, there are some people that, like, on Instagram or Facebook that I'm that I've known for a very long time, like you and, you know, Jess, who was on one of my earlier podcasts, who are just very aware of the social justice issues and just what's going on. And they're not,
I would hope there'd be a lot more of those people now. Like, I feel like if there is any silver lining in that orange thing being around president, you know, it's that it really has brought out of the woodwork a lot of people that, you know, either didn't realize they were activists or we just didn't all know one another before. So, like, yeah. I said, I have lived here for 12 years, and it wasn't until after the election that I actually met any progressive people in my town. I mean, there's plenty in Boston and Cambridge, but yeah. I live out in the suburbs in a...
You live in Walpole, right?
Yeah, in a very small white town that likes things not to change a whole lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, that had really... you know, unpleasant history with, like, busing and, you know, other, like, they really don't have any desire, per se, to be more inclusive.
And I think that you said, too, that they don't like change. I think that's a really good segue
well,
into...
Well, I mean, nobody likes change.
No, but... in a certain way, and I think that is a, it's very interesting. So, one of the big things that I always tell people when I have this kind of talk about this lack of diversity in the crafting industry, I'm like, why is the industry so white?
Right.
And I think one of the big things is that this industry was not made for everyone. And well, I say, look at Mad Men. Mad Men was a great representation of, like, how in marketing and media, products were geared towards the white middle class family. All these magazines and things you see, you didn't see any people of color. So now we're in a situation where our country is becoming more and more diverse, and people who are African-American, Latino, Asian, want things that represent them.
And, yeah, absolutely.
And this industry is... I mean, why is the industry so white?
Well, I mean, so I said nobody likes change. Nobody likes change when they've already got things their way, right?
Yeah.
Like, obviously, we want change if we see things that are wrong. We want to change them. But if you're comfortable... Well, you know, you don't want to become uncomfortable. That's a hard thing for people. I mean, so it's partly that, but I was thinking about this because you had said this stuff, talking about some of this stuff, and so I was thinking about this last night when I should have been sleeping, but that's a, you know. Anyway.
Okay, it happens.
You know, mentally debating stuff with yourself. It's a great way to, you know, have insomnia. But I was thinking about it and, like, the history of hobbies, right? So it wasn't until... really the last 150 years or so that hobbies were, like, a major thing. And they really were, in this country at least, you know, dominantly white people were the ones that had hobbies because they were the ones that had the access to the money and the leisure time to be doing hobbies. So that's one part of it.
Well, I've also said that it's about... I feel like, thinking about my great-grandmother and my grandmother's generation, right? They knitted, they crocheted, they sewed, but it was more out of necessity.
Well, see, that's what I was going to say, too, is, like, it's not a fun hobby.
It was their job, too. They were seamstresses. Like, you know, it was, and they passed that on down to their children, their grandchildren, and we have been able to take it as a hobby and something that we enjoy doing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that, I agree. I'm saying I agree with you, but in the same sense that, like, it was... other people were doing it, but it was geared towards...
Right, absolutely. It's not that, you know, black women didn't do fiber arts, but they were doing them, like you said, out of the need to clothe their children or whatever. And so that may be part of why... Right, if you were working, you know, as a seamstress, that you may not have really wanted to come home and, you know, pick up your knitting. That may not have been something that seemed like a treat.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, now I think that more people are, you know, working in offices and things, you know, of that nature, that they want to be doing something that's more tactile and physical.
Absolutely.
But there still may not be that history of, like, to, you know, white woman, you may think of, like, oh, your granny who did these, you know, this nice crochet and made lace and wasn't it happy and nice. Whereas, you know, women of color might think of, like, their grandmother, you know, coming home exhausted after a day of, you know, mending and whatever. And it just may not have the same resonance, I think, for some people.
Yeah.
You know, so that may be part of it.
And I mean, one of the things I think about this industry now, and so when I started... the business, I did my first trade show. It was the TNNA trade show, the National Needle Arts Association. Mm-hmm. And it was in 2014, and I was, like, the only black vendor there.
Oh, my God.
And it was, like, out of 200 or 300 vendors there. And at first, I didn't really recognize it because I felt like a lot of times in my life, I've always been the only black person in something. But it really amazed me because I had personally seen more people of color who knitted and crocheted and did all these things. And I actually think that, and we could talk, we're going to talk about it a little bit later, that I think that Instagram really shows you the level of diversity in this industry. I have so many followers of women and men of color.
Right.
It's just
prominent. Well, and I mean, that's the great thing about social media is if you don't have like a geographically dense enough population of people that you can see one another to get online. And I mean, we've seen this with all kinds of different like activism and different interests and different kind of subgroups, that if you can put that out there, you can gather everyone together that may not be physically in the same place, you can see, wow, okay, there actually are a lot of us who fill in the blank.
Yeah. And the thing about the media aspect of what we are doing in the crafting industry, so like on Ravelry or magazines, I've always said that when it comes to diversity and showing diversity, what I mean by that is that there are men and women of color who are knitwear designers, who are dyers, who are bloggers, who contribute a lot to this industry, but you don't necessarily hear their stories in these publications, or you don't see them prominent in Ravelry. And I always felt like the industry, like Vogue magazine, Interweave, they focus a lot on like Asian culture and design.
Interesting.
And they have like an issue of like Japanese style and textiles. Yeah. And but when it comes to
sort of called a kimono.
Yeah, but when it comes to South America or African designs or even African American culture, hip hop or hipster, whatever.
Right.
The hipster movement came out of the hip hop movement, whatever. In my personal opinion, and yet you don't see that. What you see are articles written about charities doing good stuff in South America and Africa, rather than promoting people of color in the industry who are designers.
Right.
And it took a very, very long time for one of the magazines to recognize a very, very popular blogger, Gigi, African American woman who makes these beautiful designs. She loves orange, and that's how you know her.
Yeah.
She loves orange. And she was able to get, I think, an article featured in, like, a knit scene. But, you know, I think it took a lot of people to push for that. But she should have been in there, you know, a long time ago. And I'm very proud of Gigi for getting that. But that's few and far between. There's so many people that are out there who are like, I'm like, what is wrong? Like, I don't buy magazines anymore that are in the knitting industry. Not as a boycott, but the stuff in there isn't interesting anymore. It's not telling a story. And it's a different generation. We have a different generation.
There are some, like, I know you're also a spinner. In fact, you've been spinning longer than I have. But I love Ply magazine. I think Ply magazine really does a good job of... Maybe I haven't really made a study of whether they have racial diversity, but they have a lot of people from different like parts of
the world.
Parts of the world, different fiber traditions, and so there's that. And then all the way at the other end of the spectrum, you have a magazine. I probably shouldn't say the name because I don't want to be like, you know, whatever. But there's a magazine for spinning.
It's fine.
Wild Fibers.
Okay.
That is
Wild Fibers.
The National Geographic of spinning, and my mother-in-law got me a subscription to this, and I mean, it was really sweet of her because, you know, she wanted to do something fiber related and she's not a spinner. And they have a lot of really incredible stuff in the magazine, but the tone of it is so exoticizing and so like patronizing to these people rather than being like, what can we learn from them? It's like, let's look at them like animals in a zoo, and it really just freaks me out.
when we further go along this podcast, when we talk about politics, I feel that there's a lot of tone deafness in this industry.
Absolutely,
and sometimes it can be very exhausting as a woman of color to talk about it, or just like, oh God, here we go again. What else can they, you know? You're never surprised. There's never a dull moment, but you're never surprised when something comes out and you're like, cultural appropriations. Here we go again. Just get the face paint or just blackface them at this point. Because, you know, you culturally appropriated it, and it's just, you just, you know, it's just, I don't know.
It's interesting. So my knitting community, when my partner and I first started knitting and crocheting, we were, like, we had our one friend that taught him to knit, but mostly our knitting community was online, you know, on mm-hmm. Ravelry. And so I didn't know, unless people have their own photo as their avatar, you don't necessarily know mm-hmm. what race someone is.
Yeah.
And so I, like, really had no idea. And it wasn't until I started to have more, like, face-to-face friends, you know, more, like, knitting groups that I would go to in person mm-hmm. that I realized that, like, all these white. Like, not all of them, but, like,
and I have to say, that being in Boston, I mean, well, that's we could talk, that's a whole other thing. That's like a, that's a podcast series on race and politics in Boston and crafting.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But I have to say, and I mentioned this to someone, and I actually just want to say to my audience that if you are a person of color and you feel that in your community that you're not given an opportunity to, like, teach, to really promote your business, Boston has been so great to me as a woman's lady. Like, seriously. Like, I talk about how racist Boston is and how white it is.
And it really is.
I mean, it really is. But when I decided to do a career change and I started dyeing yarn and getting into the arts more, there were so many doors that were open to me and everyone was welcoming and receptive. And whenever there's been an opportunity, even still to this day, people have come and supported me. I've had so many teaching opportunities. I was an instructor on a knitting cruise. I make half of my income from teaching with kids, from adults.
That's great.
You know, it's just, it has expanded. In other places, you don't get that opportunity. But I do think that in Boston, we're so spoiled in the fiber community because we live in New England. And we have so many, like, farms. We have so many artists in the fiber world that we can, there's so much that we can share. So I feel very spoiled, but at the same time, very blessed to be able to have gotten as far as I have with the business. I think because of where I live, and I do think because Boston is a very, like, Massachusetts as a whole is a very liberal state. And with that comes some level of, like, accepting or helping or promoting.
Well,
and it's not patronizing, like, yeah. Oh, let's help this poor, like, black girl out.
Right.
It was like, no, you're really great at what you do. You should come and you should do it. Right.
Yeah. And so, well, and I mean, it would be tempting to say that, like, knowing how great your yarn is, that, mm-hmm. like, people anywhere would have been like, wow, this is great yarn, and not thought as much about who made it. But, of course, I'm sure that there would be some places where that might not be the case.
I used to go on Ravelry all the time. And now that I don't work at the places that I do, I can say that when I was working and I was just annoyed, I would spend an hour and a half after lunch on Ravelry because I was looking for patterns. I was like, I get out of work in 4 hours. I want to knit something. I need to make something. And
right.
So for people who are just joining, and some of you who don't knit, Ravelry is the database. It's a social network, but it's also a database of and thousands of different groups that you can join based upon your interests. I love Sherlock Holmes. I swear I'm going to do a podcast on Sherlock Holmes. And I'm on the fan page. And then the Anna Green Gables. And then, like, there was the Barack Obama when he was running for president. Like, all these different fan pages, but mostly it's patterns. And so I spent a lot of time on Ravelry in the beginning phases. And depending on where you were in your knitting, when I joined Ravelry, you had to wait, like, 2 weeks. You had to, like...
Oh, you were an early adopter.
I was, yeah. You had to, like, sign up. You're like, go on Ravelry. And you're like, what's Ravelry? And then they're like, 2 weeks, and then you're on the list. And then you get in, and you're like... And then it was, like, just amazing things of, like, just, it was just great. So I was definitely...
Yeah, by the time I joined, I think it was only a couple day wait.
Oh, so yeah, that was, but that's still early. Like, this was, like, a 2 week wait. They were, like, just getting started.
Yeah, that's funny.
So, but now it's changed. I feel like it's so saturated that you can't, and mind you, I still choose Ravelry when I teach or when I'm looking for a pattern. It's still the go-to place for knitters and crocheters to find patterns, to find knitting groups and other resources. Discontinued yarns, people may have them in their stash and are willing to trade.
But you feel like just socially for hanging out,
exactly.
You're
kind of over it. Yeah, I feel that. Well, a couple things. I guess my question for you is that, do you think Ravelry has become stale? But for me, it's kind of like, it's so saturated that when you try to find, like, the patterns you can filter out, that's, like, a great database.
Yeah,
but when you
amazing.
Go to groups, there's some just groups that are like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, what is this? Like,
oh yeah,
no, it's like unicorn mythical animals or something. Like, I'm just like, just, or you know, it's just so much. And that, and what Jess and them are doing was just to make it more open and not have like companies take your data and to let it's really the, I feel like they put together a database and they allowed the community to decide in a way what it should be. But people also can be very kind of just like trolls.
Yeah. I don't know. So on the one hand, I agree with you that Ravelry is much more responsible, you know, with people's data and everything than, you know, say Facebook or whatever. And also in terms of like all of these groups, whether they're, you know, craft related groups or whether they're, you know, like you were saying, some other fan groups that just happen to live on Ravelry that aren't related to knitting at all. And, you know, they're mostly populated by knitters who also happen to be Sherlock fans or whatever. But, you know, whether like whatever the kind of group it is, one thing I love about Ravelry is it's just so readable. Like Facebook is such a hot, like you can't ever, like you can't ever find a post that you made. If you commented on someone else's post, it's not searchable. So if something's a reply to something else, like the threading on Facebook just doesn't thread at all.
Oh, that's such a good point.
And like Ravelry, like just the way it works, like functionally speaking, it's just an amazing platform for conversation. And if you, let's say someone has mentioned a pattern, you can find where they mentioned it. So it's not necessarily just looking at the pattern, but if you want to know how does that thing, like you're looking at the pattern photo and you're like, do I want to spend $5 on this pattern? Well, let me look at what people have said about it. Mm-hmm. And right on the pattern, the way the database works, you've got that tab where there's forum posts that have been made about that pattern. And so it links back to it.
Yeah, I think that over the course of time, I think Ravelry has definitely like improved things. I will say that when we talk about the top 20 like patterns, like they always have the designs, like the top 20 designs, top 100 designs. Right. I always click on it when I'm on there. Of course, it's a sea of white women, but personally, the issue that I have with Ravelry is that there's some original designers on there.
Yes.
I do think Stephen West, he's got his own spiel. Like, I can't do brioche. I mean, I can do brioche. I choose not to.
You're ahead of me then. I haven't figured it out yet.
He beat the shit out of brioche, and I just can't do brioche. I just can't do it. I did brioche, like, one brioche project, and then everything was brioche, brioche.
Just, like,
and then he was, I mean, he beat the hell out of that.
Yeah.
And I just was like, I'm done. And then, you know, last summer, I was in a boot. I hurt my left foot.
I remember, yeah.
And I was like, it was the worst situation. The business was turning. I was redoing the business model. And being in a boot in the summer, you're just like,
awful.
What the hell?
Yeah.
So I, JP Knit and Stitch, my local yarn store, I did the Find Your Fade shawl. And I was totally against it because Ravelry was doing
yes.
it.
Yeah, sometimes it does get
but,
like that. It's
but
like
at
the popular
this point,
patterns are
I was so like, yeah. So, but you know, you're belligerent when you're like, you're like a drunk. You're like, I don't care. I'm just gonna knit this thing, even though everybody's done it, but I swear that I would never do it.
That's really
But you
funny.
Do, because you're just so far gone, and you're trying to walk fast in 100-degree weather with a boot on, but you can't walk fast. So I ended up making the Find Your Fade shawl, which is a rule that I don't make things that are popular on Ravelry. Anyway, I wore it. I'll tell you, I wore it this winter. But I really liked the pattern, and I don't know if that was, like, her original design, because I saw another design that looked similar that was done before she did. But either way, everyone now has come up with a same format, but just changed the design. And I'm like, I don't want to see that. It shouldn't be.
Well, I mean, that
like, happened,
where's
the originality
like, with Wingspan, and, like, almost,
like,
every popular
like, the Hitchhiker
pattern.
Was great, and now it's like, oh, that's Hitchhiker. No, it's the, it's the eyelet something or another. I'm like, no, it's the Hitchhiker.
Right. Like, you have modified somebody else's pattern. Like, don't play like that's your
and you're
design.
And they're making tons of money off of it. Right. Or so anyway, I just, with Ravelry, I feel like you have a certain level of, like, I would love a section where it's, like, original designers and then reruns.
That's a good idea.
Original designers and reruns. Because I want to filter out with things that, you know, people can design whatever they want on Ravelry.
Right.
But there are things which later on, I have a segment called Hot Mess Crafting History where we talk about things that I'll talk to you about that later. But
okay.
There's a segment on that. But like, I think on Ravelry, like, it's free. Anyone could free to search. You can buy patterns, you can get them free, but people just put up a lot of stuff, and they now do. It's become so saturated that Instagram is like the new crack.
That's
of,
what you
it's
were
the new
telling
crack
me.
Of crafting. Right,
but it's not like the thing oh, about it Instagram. Is. No, I'm sure it is, but it's just like it's all the pictures, and so the nice thing for me about Ravelry is if I want to just surf pattern pictures, I can look at that.
This
but if
is
I
so much
have
better.
Conversation, then I can also have that.
I know, but this is so much better. Let me tell you what I love about it. So I am making. I think it's a Caitlin Hunter. It's a very popular pattern. I realized, but I purchased the pattern before it became popular. So now I have
to. So now you're a hipster.
I know, right?
You liked like, it before it was cool.
Exactly. So, like, right when she put it, I was like, this is so sharp, I'm going to do it. But I finally got to it, and everyone and their mother has done it in the last year. So people wonder why if you're indie dyer and your business is growing, how often do you knit? Not often, because by the time you find a really cool pattern, everyone and their mother is already making it, which drives me crazy. So anyway, I'm making the Sunset Highway sweater, and it's like, you know, the yokes are in, uh-huh. which I've always loved yokes before yokes became popular. Yeah. I mean, everyone has... The story is similar to that. But, I forgot what I was going to say. So I'm doing the Caitlin Hunter sweater and, I just forgot. Okay. I have to come back to that.
Okay. All right. We'll
so, Instagram. See what happens when you're having a good time. Uh-huh. So I was struggling with the main color, like uh-huh. the bottom of the base. Uh-huh. And so on Instagram, you can tag like Sunset Highway sweater.
Okay.
And Caitlin Hunter. And if you do Sunset Highway sweater, it has anyone who's taken a photo or posted whatever they've made. And so instead of like going on Ravelry and clicking on each of the
people's account,
it'll have all the photos and you can click on the photo and see the comments that people have made. So you can have find your fade, find your fade in the hashtag, and then everyone who's ever posted on Instagram, their fade. It's on there. And then, like, the comments and the yarn that they use. And I'm like, this is so awesome. I don't have to, like, go on the computer. I can just, like, on my phone, type in what I want to see, and there it is. And then they give you this collage of photos that interest you based upon your algorithms. So, anyway.
Sounds like fun.
So I know that you're not on Instagram.
Well, I mean, you're making a good
but
case,
I'm trying to take you to the dark side,
okay.
too.
All right. Because I have too much free time. I really need to have a little less free time. So I need more social media accounts to keep up with. That's what,
anyway,
you know, that's what we all need, right?
I just want to say Instagram is where it's at. It's a lot of fun. Okay. So we could go back and talk about diversity in the crafting industry, but the other big thing is that I love politics. And this podcast is called Polycraft. Talk a little bit about crafting, diversity, what we're doing, and then we talk about politics.
Okay.
Because the pussy hat movement put a lot of people in the crafting industry more focused on politics. One of the things I want to say first that a lot of people don't know is I think over 300 women across the country are running for office for this fall.
Which is awesome.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
Because so women are better at making decisions. And I don't care if people are like, well, that's a really sexist thing to say. I don't care. It's at this point.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
yes.
we've seen what has happened when you have men making all the decisions. So,
for
like,
centuries.
Right. And I mean, like, the other thing is we can't guarantee that women are always going to make better decisions, but, like, I don't see how we could make worse decisions, so let's try it at this point, right? I mean.
I know, right? So, yeah. So, I feel, let's talk about the pussy hats for a second,
yeah.
And then we'll talk 45.
Oh.
And Michael Cohen.
Ugh.
And
I know so much crazy.
Will and I were talking about this before we started the podcast when she came over. I can't keep up with the crazy shit that happens every day, every week in this administration. I don't know who came. Rachel Maddow does like a great job of like she's got a staff, right? She's got a board of like everyone that's been fired, resigned, left in administration. And it's only been like a year and not even 6 months. So,
yeah.
I don't have that type of space to do that, but I can say that it's a hot, hot mess, and it's hard to keep up. So we're going to talk a little bit about, the pussy hat movement in politics and what that was about and what we kind of, where is it now? And then we're going to talk about 45, and I really want to talk about Michael Cohen and this hot mess. His personal lawyer just got raided by the FBI. Not just his office, but the hotel he was staying at, his home,
which
his
is so
office.
Great.
I mean, yeah. And it's like, you're a lawyer? You're a lawyer who's supposed to be, what? So, I think it's hit a whole new level of he done fucked up. All right.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm gonna say.
Yeah. No, that's well. And I mean, of course, then he went on Twitter and was talking about how attorney-client privilege is dead, and it's like, you do understand that attorney-client privilege does not apply if the attorney has committed a crime. Like, yeah. That's not how that works. But of course, he doesn't know that. Like, he doesn't.
Ugh.
He's not like in a fact-based
world. I don't know. He's not even a fictional world. I don't know where his head is at.
And it's like he just says whatever seems like it might help right at that moment with no kind of forethought. And so, like, it doesn't mean anything. None of it means anything.
I can't. Okay, all right.
I know.
Right. Anyway, pussy hats.
All
right, so did you make any pussy hats?
I made one. I made one pussy hat for myself. That was knitted. I sewed a bunch of, out of fleece that I gave away
that's so funny because... Yeah. If you knitted or you crocheted, you were like, I work one day a week at Stitch House. So I was like, I'm going to make a sample.
Well, I know you
made
some.
And then
I made
a pussy hat. And then all my non-knitting friends were like, can I get a pussy hat? And I was like, fine, I'll make it.
Yeah.
They were giving me like wine, giving me chocolate. I was like, you don't have to give me anything. This is like, you know. And then I think at some point when people, and it made international news, this whole pussy hat thing.
Right.
And at this point, everyone, when people finally caught on to what we were doing, they were like, can I get one? And we were like, I can't make one in two days for you. And people were just sewing up fabric and fleece. They were like, here you go.
Well, and I was in a weird situation. I had a family member that was sick. And so I had left here and gone back to New Mexico to help take care of her. And so I was super, super busy. And in fact, I barely made it to the march in Santa Fe.
Wow.
Because like, I was like, how am I gonna like logistically with taking care of her and everything else? And so I didn't have a lot of time. So I knitted the one hat for myself, which by the way is now in the Fuller Craft Museum out in Brockton.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
About Fuller
Craft being there. The pussy hat being there.
So Fuller Craft has this big wall of pussy hats that were donated to them, that they collect, and so they're all different kinds of, you know, different shades of pink, different kinds of yarn, different, you know, some of them have, like, embroidered cat whiskers, you know, they're pretty good representation. Mine is totally plain vanilla, stockinette, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they've got some other pussy hat-related things throughout the museum, and it's a little bit weird, right? Because, like, they started collecting them at a time when the meaning hadn't really quite solidified, I feel like. It was such a great symbol in some ways. Like, obviously it's problematic, but it ticked so many boxes. Like, it's rare to come across something that works on that many different levels. And so, like, I can understand why people really thought that, like, this was great and we should, like, celebrate it and we should put it in a museum and we should whatever. And it's, you know, in a museum because it was a really transformative thing that happened.
It was craftivism.
Yeah.
It was craftivism at its, like, forefront. It was,
you
know, someone said, we're going to do this pattern. We know we're doing this march. We're going to make these
pussy everything just came together.
And people were knitting it like crazy.
Yeah. And like just kind of there were these layers of meaning that work, you know, because it referred to 45. It referred to, you know, just women
grabbing
having
them
more
out
power,
of pussies.
Reclaiming
it.
Yeah. And then it also just was amazing to see this, like, sea of pink hats. And now I should, like, be really clear here. I hate pink. So me to make a pink hat was a kind of a thing.
My sweater, the Sunset Highway sweater, I'm actually, the bottom part is, like, magenta fuchsia. Right. And that's as close to pink you're going to get.
Yeah. Well, and mine's actually my hat was actually a darker pink as well. But, because I wasn't, like, bubblegum pink is just not gonna come near me, really. That's not my thing. But it was amazing to me. So it unpacked for me a lot of the layers of, do I hate pink because I just hate pink, or do I hate pink because pink is girly and I've always been told girly is bad? You know what I mean? Like, so to the extent that, like, strong women tend to not like pink because it's too girly, that we need to really stop and think about that. Like, really? We're saying girly is bad? Like, fuck that. Girly is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it's like people who are like...
To me, it could have been in any color and it would have been amazing. But I think the pink symbolizes how pink has been associated with femininity and
right.
and trying and, to reclaim yeah. it in a more powerful way and
right.
thinking about what 45 said on that tape yeah. and things like that. I also feel that with the Pussy Hat and what in a movement and what everyone was doing, as a woman of color, it was, you know, some women of color who I knew just didn't want to participate. Because, mind you, the Pussy Hat movement, like, the Pussy Hat started just right after the election, right? Right. And women of color, particularly black women, were like, what the fuck is wrong with white women? Why right. did the majority of these white women vote for this man?
Right.
And where it was like, all these women of color voted for her. And throughout the whole election, and I know people are like, the election's over with, but I don't care. As a woman of color, I mean, it's not over with because we...
Like, we're living with the consequences.
And we continue to, you know, yeah, we're living with the... Elections have consequences. Right. Not voting has a consequence. And this is what happens. If yeah. you voted for the Green Party, those Johnson and whatever her name, Jill Stein, yes. like, this is what happens. Like,
yeah.
you can't say, oh my gosh, I can't believe Trump's doing whatever. If you didn't vote or you voted for those other people, right. this is what happens. Period. Right. But I feel that with, like, the Pussy Hat movement, I was knitting these things, but I was still so enraged that I'm making these hats for people that I love and I support.
Yeah.
But as a whole, I'm looking left and I'm looking right. And I'm like, I know that a lot of my white friends have people in their family who voted for this man.
Yeah.
And then the only thing that they're going to say is, well, like, I didn't vote for trust? Them. And yeah. I felt like, who do I not only just trust, but I felt like I was betrayed because yeah. the media kept saying, well, I don't think she's going to turn out the people of color, the vote for people of color.
Which,
and
totally,
but we
yeah.
the people of color make the Democratic base.
Right.
And I want to say this because I haven't really said this out loud. And as a collect, as women, like we talk about the Pussy Hats, it's women and the number of women who are running for political office. We need each other, whether we're black, white, Asian, gay, straight, transgender. We need each other. And I don't feel that a lot of white women think that if they want a higher salary, that it's not about them. It's about all of them. So when you right. talk about equal pay, you need to recognize that people of color, particularly, I mean, African-American women get paid less than white women, but right. Latinos get paid less than black women and white women. So when we talk about that, we do need to break down the race disparity within that. And you can't, and I always say, you can't have one without the other.
Right.
So we have to work together. It's not, it's a collective whole, and let people of color lead.
Yeah.
Like, if we're making, if we're the backbone, as Tom Perez said, of the DNC, if we're the backbone of the Democratic Party,
then, like, let's show some fucking respect.
Exactly. Just don't use us for a vote, because it's not going to really... Because this isn't going to... This should just be like, you get our vote, and then the policies continue not to impact us.
No, and it's terrible.
I mean, because we're going to just sit up and say, you know what? We're just going to sit out. Like,
yeah.
And people say, well, elections have consequences. You just said that. I said, yeah we understand that.
Right.
But our vote could be a sign of protest. We keep voting, but we're just tired. We're at a crossroad as a country.
Well, I mean, look at, like, you know, 90-some-odd% of the black women in Alabama turned out to vote for Doug Jones.
And look at what he's done already. And he's playing the fence. I call him Mitt Romney light.
Yeah, and it's so disappointing. It's like, okay, dude, you're a civil rights lawyer. Like, you're in office because black women turned out to vote for you, but this is, like, what,
you're
you know.
You're playing the fence.
Then he was, like, he voted for something. It was something related to healthcare. But I was just, like, are you fucking kidding me?
And
here?
With him, I say to him, he thinks that he's going to have an easy, breezy time.
Yeah.
This is a special election.
Yeah.
This is a special
election.
That's
not going to happen.
And he's trying to hold on to two type of votes. And it's like, listen, those Trump supporters in Alabama are not...
They're not going to vote for you anyway.
Exactly. You need to make sure that you
to
really
serve the people that actually are there for you.
Exactly, exactly. And so when I think about the Pussy Hat movement, we're going back and forth, but think about the Pussy Hat movement, I feel like, in a way, everyone who could craft came out collectively and not only marched, but created these pussy hats, whether they were sewn, whether they were crocheted or knitted. And we gave out a lot. People were just making donated tons.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was a sea of pink.
Yeah, the fuchsia, millions of hours of work that went into creating. When you look at those pictures and they're a sea of pink, those are, I mean, even the ones that were sewed, you know, I could make a, you know, fleece one in, what, like half an hour or whatever. But even so, like, that's, you know, that adds up with just the time, you know.
Still have a pussy hat.
Yeah.
But don't you find it interesting that as soon as it ended, very few people started wearing their pussy hats?
I don't know. I still know some people that do, but that's its own whole problematic thing.
But like, all that time, like, literally, it was just like you. As many as pussy hats were made,
they all went somewhere.
Being in New England,
you'd see them more.
Yeah, and I've worn my pussy hat a couple times.
But then I don't know. See, the thing
is,
was it just for symbolism? I guess it was. So I guess that's complicated. My thing is. Now they're so complicated. Like, it was a great moment, and then it became so much more complicated right after that. And I don't feel like I would wear mine anymore at this point, because it's... So obviously, as you know, like, Black women have made some Black women have felt like the color, in addition to just being pink is girly, that the pink, you know, it's like pink pussies, okay? Like, that would be, like, more the color of white women's pussies. And it's not... Like, we get that that's not
I've been hearing about that. I mean, as far as that's a conversation. I haven't heard any other Black women talk about that.
Interesting. I haven't in person, but I've heard a lot of people online say that they felt really excluded, and, you know, that they felt that that was, like, very tone-deaf white feminism. Not that it was tone-deaf at the date of the march. Because it was a thing that happened.
So, like, nitty gritty, and you're like, okay, we're not actually, let's not talk about the actual pussy right now. Yeah. People are like, I mean, we could talk about it now, but it's like, when people say those comments, it's like, come on, it's.
So I felt like that at first. When I first started hearing that, I was like, okay, everyone knows that, like, hot pink is not the color of anyone's actual vulva. And, you know, can we move on? But then I started to hear a lot of white women who weren't just like, can we move on? But we're really angry about it. And I'm like,
white fragility.
Okay.
Yeah, it was
the white fragility was overwhelming. And it wasn't the pussy hat that tainted the pussy hat for me. It was the white fragility that resulted in any critique of it. Mm-hmm. It was like, if they had just been cool about it, then maybe we could have, like, worked it out. But people were not cool about it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, if someone says that their feelings are hurt, like, it doesn't matter if you think their reason is stupid, their feelings are still hurt. So maybe just, like, don't be a dick.
Well, that's interesting that you said that. Because...
And, like, it was with the transgender thing, too. Like, I know a lot of trans women who... made pussy hats, wore pussy hats, thought that, like, in the heat of the moment, that was a great response. But I also know a lot of trans women who are like, okay, but now could we cool it with the vaginas? Because, like, that's not inclusive feminism either. And so, like, I get it. Like, it was a metaphor. It wasn't saying you're only a woman if you have a vagina. That wasn't the whole point of the hat. But at the same time, if you're critiqued, and instead of saying, oh, yeah, I could see how it could be seen that way, but that wasn't how I intended it, so I'm sorry. People were like, well, that's not how I intended it. You intentionally twist it and take it that way. It was that fragility. It was like, if your response to being critiqued is to be angry at the most vulnerable members of your movement, then you need to step back. And so that was why, for me, like, I would not at this point wear a pussy hat, because I just feel like too many people have missed too many opportunities to step back and be inclusive. And so the whole thing has just really soured for me, I think.
I agree with you on that. I think for myself, too. And I think the last thing about the pussy hats is that, you know, I feel that I don't know if we'll ever have a moment in history and like craftivism, where we really unite everyone around a particular project.
Thing.
They tried to do that for the March for Our Lives,
right?
With the Evil Eyes gloves,
and it just didn't take off the same way. No, I was gonna say the pussy hat was a really rare thing that just was the right thing at the right moment with, like, all these different resonances that was awesome. And I think I'm really glad that it happened, but I just wish that people had not, like, completely, like, failed to find their chill in the aftermath.
Yeah.
That's all.
Well, that's being said, we talk about white fragility or whatever. I wanted to say that I feel that with this Russian investigation, white people lost their shit.
Yeah.
And a lot of levels. And
right.
It's not saying that no one else of color has not been upset about the situation.
Yeah.
I personally feel that white people, particularly, are really upset that the election was meddled and their vote felt kind of tainted.
Right, because we don't have as much experience with having our votes suppressed.
And in my head, I was like, white people have been doing it to people of color since the founding of our country.
Yeah.
Right? So, and we still deal with it today.
Yeah. Well, and just the amount of talk about it.
And then the amount of energy that we've, and I said to someone, I said, I am much more wanting to discuss the Russian investigation in relation to Facebook and Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah.
Than I am that some, according to Trump, some 400-pound or 500-pound kid, like was doing all this, right?
Yeah.
But that's not even, it's not true. But, no. You know, I'm much more concerned about how our data and how Cambridge Analytica and Facebook fucked up a lot of things.
Yeah.
And allowed that to happen.
Maybe they did. Like, the thing is, it's hard to know. It's also possible that Cambridge Analytica is kind of a fig leaf for some even worse things that have been going on. Cambridge Analytica, one thing I have read is that they're really good at PR, but it's not as clear that they're actually good at influencing elections. So we just don't know. They may have influenced elections and a lot. But it could also be a cover for more, you know, for, like, the actual tampering with voting machines, things like that, that are much harder just to kind of get our arms around. Like, we don't know as much about them.
I agree. Some states, we don't have a universal, like, election. States have type of thing. Some states have electronics, some do paper.
Right, and everyone, they have to do their own thing, and are they good at it? We don't know.
Yeah, like, and the one thing with the Russian investigation, and I talked about how they had fake stories and fake news, and people were saying that I don't believe that the election votes, the way that people actually voted, were tainted with.
Yeah.
I don't believe that. I believe that the psyche of America's minds were fucked up. And when I say that in the sense that when you look at media and marketing, when someone wants to put out a product, we are actually here to persuade you to buy something.
Right.
Right. And in journalism, you're supposed to be very objective. You're not supposed to have an opinion when certain articles are written, but on cable news, you're allowed to have an opinion. We're persuading you to do something.
Yeah.
And it's wrong that fake stories and fake news were used to persuade. But in a way, the biggest issue that our country deals with is critical thinking.
Yeah.
Well, who, what, when, where, and why, and how.
Yeah.
People are much more reactionary.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot more people need to go to therapy.
That's probably true.
You know, like we talk about on Ravelry with trolls or Facebook or, you know, Twitter. People are, you know, they talk about, I mean, 45 is the number one cyber bully you can get.
Yeah.
But I talk about people really attacking people for things and going at it, and I'm like, you need to just chill. You need to go have a glass of wine if you're of age. Like, you know, smoke pot if you want. I don't care. Like,
but deal with your resentments some way other than just like by starting fights on the internet.
You know, right? So, when I think about the Russian investigation, I think more deeply about the role that Cambridge Analytica and Facebook played. Facebook is trying to act very innocent, and I have to tell you, I am on Facebook. I have moved away from posting more on my personal Facebook page, but like my Instagram is owned by Facebook.
Right.
And so my business is run basically on Instagram.
Right.
Like that's where the crafting industry is at.
Yeah.
So, but all my photos are connected to my Facebook page for business. And I don't do those quizzes anymore. I don't do any of that stuff because it's just time consuming. I don't have the time.
Right.
But I feel that, you know, there were so many during that time. I was like, why are there so many quizzes?
Right.
Or why are there so many, like, responses to, like, it just it just seemed weird. Like, even BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
Like, BuzzFeed has come out with really great articles on the Trump administration. But at the same time,
so weird because,
but at the same time, you took all those quizzes. And I'm thinking to myself, is there a Cambridge Analytica light working with BuzzFeed taking
their
data?
I wondered that too.
Like, because whenever you took a BuzzFeed quiz, they wanted to connect with your Facebook.
Yeah.
Right? So, I'm not accusing BuzzFeed, but I'm just saying that there's a lot of social media that there were quizzes and tasks that all interacted with Facebook.
Yeah.
And how did that happen? And how did they use our data?
Right.
The fact that if you took it with, and a lot of people don't know this, Cambridge Analytica, they would take, you could go, Cambridge Analytica, from my understanding, could put like a quiz up, and then they could, you could do the quiz, but certain profiles.
Right.
But then they would take my profile, even if I didn't take the quiz,
right,
and get that information. And then my friends' friends, and then right. they'd build their base. So they right. didn't need a huge population of people to do it. They just needed a certain amount.
Well, we don't know what the next thing is going to be, because the next one's going to be different. It's not going to be like that
Facebook
again.
Facebook knew that they were doing right. something. And then they got caught because the whistleblower came out, and now they have to, like, you know.
Right, but I think they need to be regulated. Like, something different. It might be something different. It might not be quizzes. It might be something we don't even know yet. Like, whatever is happening now.
Because, your likes. The number of times you've, like, I refuse like to, like, like articles. I'm going to try to, like.
See, I'm bad about that. I
do,
click
too.
Like on all kinds of.
Or save, if you save a link, or, like, you just don't know. And it's true now that people are understanding that, yes, Facebook makes money off of our data. They make money off of that.
Right.
They make money off of advertising and our data. That's how they survive, and that's why they're worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because companies, that's that, your mind and your psyche and how you are as a person is so valuable
right.
to corporations. Because that's how they change their products, that's how they market their products, yeah. and it's a gold mine now.
It's that whole thing of if you're getting something for free, then you're not the client, you're the product.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's something that I think people are now understanding a lot better. And I because of that, I wasn't on Facebook until like a year and a half ago, 2 years ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, like we've been friends on Facebook for most of the time I've been on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't on. So I wasn't on Facebook, and then I got involved in organizing against the gas pipeline. You know, they wanted to transfer fracked gas from Pennsylvania up here.
Dumbasses.
Not even for us to use here, but they wanted to. They say that it was for here, but we don't actually need more gas in New England. So it was transparently obvious that it was, they wanted to get it to the Eastern Seaboard so they could export it. And so I was organizing against that, which I don't know if you know, like, there's a pipeline that was coming through West Roxbury. Yeah.
Yeah,
so there was a lot of organizing there. And then out in the suburbs where it's harder to organize and you have to kind of work more with some people who are just NIMBYs.
Are we that hooked on oil?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So what happened was that in New England, we used to have a lot of coal in our electric grid.
Mm-hmm.
And then coal, especially, you know, under the Obama administration, was, you know, it became clear that there was not a future in that,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so a lot of, as those coal plants kind of went offline due to age and whatever, they were replaced with natural gas, because there was this whole, oh, natural gas is clean, natural gas is, you know, a bridge fuel to clean energy, but it's not. It's a bridge to nowhere. But so they've put in all this gas infrastructure. Anyway, that's a tangent. But so I was organizing around that a couple years ago, and people kept being like, oh, did you see this meeting? And that, it was posted on Facebook. And I was like, I'm not on Facebook. And so finally I had to give in and be on Facebook. So that's
like,
the
I'm
going
to try to let you get on Instagram, because it's just so great.
Yeah, and so that's the only reason that, and of course now I'm totally, you know, hooked, and it's nice, I've reconnected with some friends and whatever, you know, but that's why I'm on Facebook. So I was kind of aware, like, from the beginning that they were going to be tracking some of our data, but the thing we don't know in, okay, so in, you know, 2015, when all the Cambridge Analytica stuff was going on, I wasn't on Facebook, so I don't, like, I'm not part of that, but at the same time, what are they doing right now that's going to come out in another couple of years? We don't know.
Yeah, the other, that's a good point that you made, and I said this to some, it has to deal with Edward Snowden, the guy that was the whistleblower, whatever, and I said to someone, I said, if you're surprised that the government was doing X, Y, and Z,
then you're not paying attention.
Then you're just not paying attention.
Yeah.
And I said, I am not upset with him for sharing the info. It's like you know that the government is doing this stuff.
Right.
You just choose not to pay attention to
right,
it.
Right, right.
You just don't be shell-shocked. Oh my God, I didn't know my privacy. Like, no, please. once you get a cell phone, you're
right.
done.
Right.
Like, that's just
right,
it.
Because it tracks you. Like, that's yeah. how it works.
That's
it
how criminals like, can't yeah. get away with it. And it tracks where you're at. My issue with Snowden was that he ran. And I've always felt like if you do something, you stand by it. Whistleblower, just stand by it. Whistleblower, just stand by it. You know, he ran. Like,
I don't know. I mean, that seems fair. Although it's weird that he went to Russia, given what we now
exactly.
know about Russia.
Yeah.
It does kind of make you wonder.
I just don't think you should run. If you made a decision to expose this information that was not given to the public, and you truly feel that people in this country needed to know, and you're going to be a whistleblower, then you stay your ass here and defend it and make your decision. But to me, he was saving his ass because he knew he'd be behind bars.
Yeah.
And he chose Russia as a haven because he knows the conflict right. and the tension that they have. And that's the problem. Everything else he did... I'm totally fine.
I mean, it's a reasonable point, although I have to tell you, I volunteered in the prisons here in Massachusetts for several mm-hmm. years, and it's, you know, we have fairly nice
segment.
Prisons as U.S. prisons go, which sounds like a weird thing to say, but I have to tell you that even the prisons here are pretty, I wouldn't want to be in one, so I can't blame him for not wanting to be in a prison, but you do have a point.
Yeah. But Michael Cohen. Can we talk about Michael Cohen for a second?
Sure.
The dumbass lawyer of Trump.
This guy is so weird. Like, what is
home
his, like,
office? What else? What is home office?
Hotel.
And some hotel.
Yeah.
Got raided. And
yeah.
it took a porn star
I know,
to bring this to light. And
this
I'm
is so
just
funny
like.
That it, like, it's great that it's a porn star. I love that. Because, like, it's just so of this moment.
Yeah,
but like
Stormy Daniels.
I
never
mean,
heard of her.
Like, right, but she has her shit together.
Yeah,
like,
she does.
She's an entrepreneur. She's like she's just a very together person, and like I just think she's.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that like you wouldn't have predicted, like, you know, like the Alt National Park Service thing. I follow them on Facebook, of
yeah.
course. But they're, you know, a bunch of people that work for the National Park Service and the Department of the Interior who, you know, are kind of keeping tabs on what the department's really doing. So like it's just one of those things that like who would have predicted that the resistance would be led by like park rangers and porn stars?
I know.
So much.
Right.
Love
I know.
So much.
Right. But, it's crazy that the number of people you know, they kept saying lock her up, lock her, whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like, they're locking all these men up.
Yeah.
All these men. Look at all these people who pled guilty. And I'm like, don't even get me started. Michael Cohen.
Yeah.
The personal attorney for Donald Trump.
Personal attorney and like fixer and buddy.
I mean, he's like the mafia, it seems like.
He is. He's like it's...
And the interesting is that Rosenstein,
yeah.
whatever. He's the one that signed off on it.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just like...
It's like spy versus spy shit up in here.
You don't... The type of warrant or that they got,
yeah.
you just can't go... Like, it was a very... Like, you cannot get that type of warrant unless
right.
there's legitimate... issue. And I
right.
think it was Stormy Daniels.
Yeah.
And I... This whole thing boils down to was that, you know, I think that Trump ran on as a joke.
Yeah.
He wasn't supposed to win.
No, he didn't think he was gonna win, and he was upset that he did.
I think he opened up a whole can of worms to his criminal corruptionness that
right.
he's been on going on for years.
That's pretty
and
funny.
Now he's like, crap. Like, I really done fucked up, and I don't have, like, a way of,
right.
like, getting out of it. All the stuff, if he didn't run for president, we would not be hearing about...
No.
Like,
no one would care. He would just be, like, this rich asshole.
Exactly.
Whatever.
No one would be digging any information. No one would be on any level.
Well, and I mean, of course, I don't know, you know, it's all tabloid, whatever, but I saw, I think it was, like, Us Weekly, one of the... less trashy supermarket checkout mm-hmm. line magazines said that Melania is thinking of filing for divorce.
Okay.
I don't know how they know that, and I mean it may not be true, but I was just like, oh well, that
she
would be
I have
special,
no pity for
it?
That I have no pity none whatsoever.
Like, I get that, but at the same time,
she could have left him a long time ago.
She could have left him a long time ago, but not recently, because they have a kid.
So that doesn't people.
She'll never see him again. If she were to leave, do you think that
yes.
man would let her see her child?
I don't think, from my understanding, all the women that he's had children with that have raised their kids. I think you'd be like, Baron, you're gonna go live with your mom.
Yeah, but if he, like, I think if she made it unpleasant for him. Because, like, when he got divorced from his other wives, he wasn't in the position that he's in now. Like, now it would be more of, like, a scandal. And I think... I don't know. She just... She pings some, like... I mean, of course I don't know, but, like, I suspect that, you know, there's some abuse going on there.
Jeanette, that whole situation.
I feel bad for her, but, I mean, like, who knows? Like, I also feel bad for Ivanka, and, you know, she clearly is doing it. Like, she want. I mean...
All right.
I know. I shouldn't have sympathy for her, but I kind of do.
You know, it's all on you. I don't. It's okay. That's so fine. I want to, because we're almost running out of time, I'm going to talk about two more things. Okay. Hot mess crafting history.
Right? Okay.
It's a new little kind of like segment I'm doing.
All right.
And we talk about Ravelry and all these patterns. There's something. You remember Regretzi?
Yes.
Things Regretzi that should have been
so awesome.
And I'm so glad that we were able to like experience it when it first came out. And then they had a cease and desist letter and I was just annoyed.
Yeah.
But there are some patterns and things on Ravelry that just should not be.
Yes.
And one of the things is called the Booby Hammock Bra. And it's a ripoff from some company that made this like just around your boobs, across your neck.
Right.
So that when you're wet or you're sweaty and you could just walk around, you don't have to carry a whole towel around.
Right. Which makes sense, kind of, but, like, I was always like, I don't know how well that would stay. My thing, though, with Ravelry was, like, whether you think it's a good idea or not, you ripped off someone's idea, and it wasn't a company, it was just this lady on Etsy that came up with it. So, like, you're ripping off, like, another small crafter.
But
like,
let me just really tell you cool. about, and I don't call people, try not to call people out, but I think it's Leah Moore did this pattern on Ravelry. And this is her description. Let me get my glasses on because when I read the description, I was like, I don't know what she was thinking. This is fun. It's easy. Why haven't you done it yet? Your girls, thank you. A bra for pure comfort can be worn while gardening, cooking, watching TV, or any old thing. All right. Especially great for breastfeeding. Large breasts. Triple D's to be exact. That's all I have. The pattern is quite simple and could be easily modified for different sizes by adding or subtracting stitches. Okay. Number one, why would you want to be walking out in public in your backyard with I don't even want to call it a booby bra. It's not, they called it a hammock. It's just like, it's something like burlesque-like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's not.
Yeah.
And it's not, a lot of people don't know this, but it's something that I'll talk about in another podcast with a friend of mine who is a doctor. I had a breast reduction back in 2013, and I was huge. I mean, it is what it is. A lot of people think that you go to a plastic surgeon to get breast implants. Some of us were maybe blessed to have just too much, and having large breasts make it heavy.
Yes.
And so wearing the gimmick thing that goes around your neck and covers your boob, your face, your head is going to be tucked underneath. I'm just saying, because it's so heavy.
Yeah.
Who in the hell is going to want to have big boobies walking in a garden, gardening with this towel? I don't get it. I just don't get.
Yeah, I didn't really get it either, but I guess it's one of those things where I'm like, to each their own. Like, there are some things... There are all kinds of things on Ravelry that I'm like...
Did you see the pushpin?
That was hilarious.
And it started a whole... And I'll tell you, there are people who are Trump supporters on Ravelry. Because people were, like, upset. Other people thought... I thought it was hilarious.
It was trending
number one for a good couple of weeks.
Yeah, yeah. That was hilarious. I love the wars that break out sometimes in pattern comments. It's just funny to watch. Someday I'm gonna get like kicked off Ravelry because technically in the rules it does actually say that like, you know, if you can't say anything nice about someone's work, don't say anything at all. Like there is actually a rule against like slamming pattern designers in their comments. You can do it like if you don't name names, you can talk about it like in a group, but you can't talk about it on their pattern page. But
I'm on a podcast.
Like sometimes I've come across like incredibly racist dolls, whether they're, you know,
I've seen it too.
Some of them are, you know, they're like black dolls. They're
like in blackface, red lips. Yes. Yeah, pink red lips. Yes. Yeah, like,
what are they called? There's a name for them, and the
words hot mess. Right out of my they're head. Called a hot mess.
No. But like there was a historical term for them, and it's not coming to my mind right now. But that's fine. We don't need to, you know. But then there are also like you know like these fake like Native American dolls with like these fake feather headdresses and like bullshit
cultural
like that.
Appropriation.
Yeah, yeah, like all kinds of cultural appropriation. I've seen beer can koozies that were Confederate flags. I've seen like all kinds of just really
and the reality like, is that you can do that on Ravelry. It's
you can it's, but it's, like I leave comments about those things and like I said I try to be tactful while also not like pulling any punches, but like someday I'm gonna probably get banned from Ravelry for it, but like whatever.
Just a quick little thing about the Confederate flags. One of the things that I've been in the last year, I mean, with Charlottesville, it's tragic, but also very a symbolic moment in our nation's history. And other, only in this, like, we, for so many decades and centuries, have honored, in the South, they've honored a lot of Confederate people who were traitors to our country. Like, they weren't heroes. They were not.
Yeah, I don't know of any other world
people will
conflict.
Say yes or no. People, no, they were not patriots to our country.
That's the thing. What other conflict can you think of where the losing side is statues? Like, the statues. Like, it's so fucked up.
Exactly. And so when people say that it's about honoring those who fought as the...
Yeah, it's like, no, they're not honorable. I mean. They were traitors, and they should not be celebrated to begin with, like, regardless of, like, the racism part, which obviously, you know, but, like, but it just doesn't make any sense either for people that go around, you know, waving American flags and Confederate flags. It's like, what are you even doing?
Yeah.
Especially people up here that have Confederate flags. I was talking.
When you get out of the city and you really get out towards rural areas of Massachusetts, like
I don't even live in a rural area, So in my town, our high school sports teams.
Oh, that's right. You're telling me this.
The Rebels.
I know.
They used to have Confederate flags on their uniforms. They don't anymore. And so people try to say, oh, it means something different now. And I mean, I guess it's up to the kids that are current students, but you can't erase the meaning just... But it's crazy. I'm like, we're in Massachusetts. We were in the Union, guys. Have you forgotten? But apparently they want to wave Confederate flags. And in fact, just the other day, just Saturday, I saw a Don't Tread on Me flag in someone's yard.
I've seen that too. Because like, that's also like New Hampshire with the whole.
And that's
like,
but that's like.
But it means something different now.
Yeah, I mean, like it's okay. So it's originally a Revolutionary War era design, but it became taken up by people not so much during the Confederate flag was kind of rebooted by the racists during the Civil Rights era. Those people also took up the Don't Tread on Me flag, and so now it's one of those things. It's like it's a dog whistle because
culturally appropriate the meaning of what it is. And
now. Like it's a dog whistle because you can't if you call someone in it, they're like, oh, it's because of its Revolutionary War significance that I like it, and you can't prove you like it because of like racism, but it's like that people will say, oh, no, that's not why I like it, but it's like that's why you like it.
Yeah.
Like, don't play.
But anyway, hot
so we've
mess
been all over the place.
Hot mess crafting the booby hammock bra, which God bless anyone who's made it.
Yeah,
I mean, don't realize how durable it would be. You shouldn't be in public with it.
Yeah.
You should just stay inside. But that's just the whole thing.
Stay inside. If people want to go out in public in it, like, whatever.
Please don't. So this is the last thing before we go. And I always want to leave kind of like on a... It's inspirational. It can be still funny. Inspirational.
Okay.
I'm going to have you go first.
Okay.
Something that you saw, you read. Something that was like... That allows people to say, yeah, I got it.
So this was actually just a meme that it's know who to attribute this quote to, which is terrible because that's the internet. It's just stealing things from everyone, right? Not attributing them. So bad me, but it cracked me up. it said, if you're going to be a smart ass, make sure you're smart first. Otherwise, you're just an ass.
Yeah. That's a good one.
So I try. So what's yours?
So I guess mine is... this past week was Maya Angelou's like 90th birthday, and I
oh sure come with the all you know the serious with just a smart ass with just a smart ass with me.
It's actually on the same kind of similar lines to that actually, and so I had the honor back in like in 2004 2005 to hear her speak at Boston College. My really good friend D had tickets, and I just hearing her voice and hearing her speak.
Yeah.
And she's funny.
Yeah.
And she's got the sense of humor that you just love. And I've always been, when I was introduced, first was introduced to Maya Angelou, it was actually in high school. It wasn't middle school, it was high school. And all of her books I read. And, you know, A Phenomenal Woman is a great poem, and Still I Rise. But one of the things she's always said is when people, and she thinks she was on Oprah when she said this, where she goes, when people tell you who they are, believe them.
Yeah.
And
so important.
It's, as you get older, you really start to recognize that. And yeah. How you choose your friends, the people you associate with. But given kind of what we're going through as a country, you know, and I...
Right, that would have solved a lot of problems.
Yeah, and I don't like to try to point fingers and say, it's your fault, this fault, but when people... What I think that this... Hopefully what people have learned is that when people reveal who they are, believe them.
Right. There were so many people who said, oh, I didn't think he was really going to do that.
Yeah, like...
But he said he was! Like, where were you?
So, like, you... And it goes to your people and your business, and, like, the work that, you know, I'm doing as well. When people who reveal who they are, their character, believe them that this is who they are.
Right.
And either, if it's a good feeling, great. If it's not so great, then, you know, part ways.
Yeah.
But in the end, I leave you on that note for Maya Angelou, and we'll leave you on that meme.
Okay.
If you're going to be a smart ass, you know.
Make sure you're smart.
Make sure you're smart.
Otherwise, you're just an ass.
All right, Shabilla, thank you so much. Shabilla, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Diane.
This is great.
This has been so much fun.
You have to come back.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
All right, so if you haven't gone online, our website is ladydyarns.com. Our shop is full of yarn right now. And our May mini skein club will be with my single ply fingering weight yarn. And it's going to be inspired by 8 women in... who are activists in politics, actually. 20% of the revenue made for that month will go to a women organization or a political candidate who's running. And I'm getting would like to take feedback from anyone. So if you haven't signed up for the May Mini Skein Club, please do. And it's going to be 8 women, which I will send out in the newsletter and post on my Facebook and on my website. So thank you for joining us, and have a wonderful...